This morning, I want to do something that I used to do more often when I used to teach here in Tampa more often, which is every now and then just take questions. You know, if you go back to the original teachings of the Buddha, what you find is a lot of the things that have been encapsulated in the corpus of what's called sutras or suttas of the teachings of the Buddha, that they really were dialogues, that he was really responding to questions, and I think that keeps things alive. So any questions you may have about practice, your own life, awakening, just wait. I like enthusiasm. or about, you know, your readings about Buddhism, the spiritual path, we will you'll feel free to answer any of it. But I do want to spend a couple of minutes first just talking about our path of practice here, just so, you know, there are always new people, so I want to help make that clear. So starting tomorrow, our community, this means members of our community are beginning three what we call practice periods or intensives. These are sort of people sign up for them, and each of the various intensives have various topics, various commitments, various paths of practice. So we have about 125 members who are involved in these three different. And I'm saying that because this is the first time we've offered three. Not too many years ago, we offered one. And then we offered two at the same time. And now we offer three at the same time. This is the first time. And why do we do it? It is because it's in relationship to our path of practice. And in our community, we have developed a path of practice that we call the path of mindful living, the path of Dharma, and the path of wisdom. And I say that because it's important that we understand that the spiritual tradition of Buddhism is a developmental path that takes us from where we begin, but its object is to take us somewhere. Okay, but again, at the same time that it's a developmental path that people can move along, at the same time it's an acknowledgement that there are many people. There's a great diversity in people and in our community, and people may be looking for different things, right? Some people may just be looking for, a high school degree. Right? Some people are in high school, but they're really doing it as a stepping stone to going to college, right? More advanced. And some people who are even in college may be seeing their college career as a stepping stone for some type of career or some type of further learning. Is that clear? So in the same way, we want to acknowledge that here. So this is on the website and it's more developed, but I think it's important that we understand that there is a path of practice, there is a path of development. When Salima was saying that we bow to the Buddha, the capacity of all of us to awaken to our true nature, our Buddha nature, that is the end goal, we might say, of the path. But we all begin somewhere, and so where we begin is what we call the path of mindful living. We do that. One, because it's an entrance way, but two, because it's a necessary foundation for the next two. And the problem these days, because spirituality, and in this case Buddhism or Dharma, is so often transmitted in a helter-skelter way. People go to this group, people go to that group, people listen to talks on the web by this teacher, by that teacher. You can get every book in the world on Buddhism. It's very easy to kind of have a very helter-skelter, scattershot approach to spiritual development. And not understanding that traditionally it was presented in this very a kind of clear step-by-step way. Not because of dogma, but because of there was a deep understanding of the human mind and how it needs to be transformed at a certain level before the next level can really make sense or be practiced. It's very easy if we have some intellectual capacity to read things, to understand things, but you may have found it is not as easy to practice them. Right? So even as simple as just, you know, concentrating on your breath for 10 minutes. Sounds simple. but to have real skill and ability may not be. It sounds simple to be a compassionate human being, to be a kinder human being, to be a more patient human being, to have a more peaceful mind, right? To let go of afflictive emotions and negative mind states. I mean, who would disagree with that? And yet we may find that the actual practice of it is not so easy because we don't have the requisite skills and abilities to do that. So, our first path quickly is the path of mindful living. You know, developing the capacity to be present. It's such a basic, you know, just be present. Be present to ourselves, be present to each other, be present to whatever we're doing. I mean, it sounds so basic, but yet we know in our world, our minds tend to be so scattered, so distracted, that even being present, right, to the beauties around us, to the people we live with, is often a challenge. You know, we've lost that ability. So this capacity to develop mindfulness where we're present to our bodies, our breath, our emotions, to each other, to reality, you know, gives us like a ground. I'm present, I'm mindful, I'm aware. Right? Now, one of the things we may become aware of or more mindful of when we develop some capacity for mindfulness and self-awareness is how screwed up we are. Right? Wow. I never thought that would be my first mindfulness. You know, what a mess my mind is. It's just all over the place. It's just this wild thing inside me that just goes wherever it wants. Even though I don't want it to go there, it goes wherever it wants. Or we become aware of, you know, all of a sudden we have self-awareness about the things we say and their effects on people. Or the mind states that we're obsessing about and the negative effects on ourselves. Or we become aware of, you know, that we're still carrying lots of baggage. You know, unresolved baggage from childhood, issues that just come out of nowhere and still condition and control us. So that's the other part of the mindful living path, you know, emotional healing. Again, very essential. Because as long as the mind doesn't have somewhat of a capacity to be present and has some stability and has some emotional stability, what you will find that when you want to go more deeply into a transformative path, there always seems to be obstacles. There always seem to be challenges. We always seem to be self-sabotaging. And a lot of that, again, is not because we're bad people or bad practitioners or we really don't have aspiration. It's really none of that. It's really more that we haven't laid a foundation. We haven't laid a foundation. And again, we are Americans, right? We want to get there quickly. And we've read the books, and we know that there's this enlightened and this whole, you know, and we want to get there, right? We don't want to have to do this, you know, this foundation work. You know, it's like you've ever constructed anything, you know, sort of the you know, who wants to dig a trench? You know, who wants to lay a foundation and dig all the, you know, in the concrete? We want to build a beautiful house and start decorating, right? Pick out the colors for the wall and pick out the furniture, right? That's what we want to do. We don't want to do this, you know, this hard, dirty foundation work. Is that clear? But without that strong foundation, you know, the capacity to build some kind of house that has some stability in it to it, will be very difficult. So that's why it's very important that we be attentive to where we're at, and that's why our first path is this mindful living path of mindfulness and the concentration and emotional healing. It's in a certain way, it's a very kind of self-oriented path, right? It's really saying, you know, I really got to get myself together. You know, I may have the aspiration to be of benefit to others and et cetera, but I got to, you know, there's some personal work that's got to be done here, some stability. Okay, now, so that's again, we may say that's a secular path, that's a very personal path, that's a very self-oriented path. And again, that's where most of us begin, whether we think we do or not. Okay? Now the second path is the Dharma path. For some people, actually, that mindful living path and emotional healing may be where they're at. Right? You know, it's really what I want. That's what I need. Nothing wrong with that. Okay? But for some people, they may think, no, there's something about this life and the way we live our lives and the way people live their lives. There's something about the whole thing that needs to be understood. Yeah. You know, something bigger is going on here in life other than just my own childhood issues and my own lack of ability to be present. You know, like, what is this life really about? And birth and death and you know what I'm saying? All these kind of bigger issues. And what is my mind? And you know, is there some purposeful, meaningful, beautiful way to live life? Right, that I really don't know about yet, or don't know how to practice. So this is called the path, we call it the path of Dharma, right? This is where we get into really all this stream of 2,600 years of Buddhist teachings and practices where human beings, just like ourselves, have experimented and looked deeply into life and have shared their results with us. Okay, so this is our path of Dharma, where we really begin to undertake more of a spiritual life, a transformative life, look more deeply into life and our own minds, emotions, psychology, philosophy, you know, really think about a real spiritual aspiration, really think about not just practicing for oneself, but also maybe practicing for others and service and love, and you know, all those bigger things, right? We've kind of, at the path of mindful living and self-healing, we're really more focused on our own self-healing and getting our act together. In the second path of Dharma, we're opening up. We want to understand this life. You know, so even if I'm mindful and I've done my own healing, you know, why is there still dissatisfaction within me? Why is there still suffering in myself and in others? Why is it that I still don't have the capacity, even though I want to help others, that I can help others? You know, some of the issues, you know, why is my mind, I still have so much affliction or dissatisfaction or unease within it? Okay, so we want to, so this is the path of Dharma, and we have lots of teachings and practices and opportunities for developing this. And then the third path, we call the path of wisdom. Okay? And these are for people who have stabilized themselves in the first path, have stabilized themselves to a certain degree in the second path, and now really are very inspired by the Buddhas and all the great teachers and masters for 2,600 years with this enlightenment, what it means to be an awakened human being, an enlightened human being, to really really understand not just intellectually, philosophically, psychology, but personally, directly experience the truths of the Buddha's awakening, to really understand the nature of reality, the nature of one's own mind in a deep, transformative way. Okay, so we call that the path of wisdom. And so, again, we have opportunities to develop in that areas. So so it's not as if we have graduation ceremonies. You are now graduated, and it's not really that we deeply inspect everybody's level of practice. But we want to give our community a guideline so they can understand what's going on, but also be able to fit themselves into, right? Knowing what they need, taking what they need, and knowing that at whatever level people are entering our community, whatever level people's aspiration is, there is something meaningful to engage them with. So there it is. And as I say, starting tomorrow, we have these three. This week, we have these three different intensives. For example, one intensive is on mindful living and mindfulness, using the tradition of Thich Nhat Hanh and the Plum Village tradition as guidelines for people in that one. The next one is on the four measurables, the Buddhist teachings on love, and really how to practice and develop. Many of us know that, I'd like to be a kinder person. I'd like to be a more loving person. I'd like my heart to really be open to other human beings. I really want to be more compassionate to people. I want to give up jealousy and envy. You know, we these things. But in Buddhism, there's a whole series of practices so we can really develop it. So that's that. There's one. There's a second intensive on the what's called the four measurables, and then the third intensive is on this really wonderful. It's really the six paramitas, these perfections, as taught in this wonderful text by the 8th century master Shantideva. It's called the Way of the Bodhisattva, and it really lays out very clearly the path for someone who wants to really awaken themselves, free themselves of all their own delusions, and really devote themselves, and wherever they are, to really being of benefit to other beings. It's called the path of the Bodhisattva. So this is what's going on. So I'll end there. And now... I'm really open to really just taking questions, responding to you, whether they're very personal questions about your own life or situations that you're maybe not clear to deal with, about your own meditative practice, or about, you know, maybe some of the readings you've done about spirituality or things you're not clear to you, Buddhism. So please don't feel shy. It's not very often that we get an opportunity to interact this way, and don't feel you got to censor yourself. You can, you know... I'll take it anyway, but we'll begin with this gentleman.
I know this word compassion. I'm just kind of curious if you say compassion.
Good. So the question is, I'll just repeat it. Yeah, thank you. But we can do that for the next one. So the question is, hey, what do you mean by the word compassion? Right, it's a good question, because it could have lots of meanings. And obviously, Buddhism is often called the path of wisdom and compassion. Right. So compassion is a word in the Buddhist tradition. It's the word is karuna, K-A-R-U-N-A. And compassion is a very interesting word in Buddhism, because it has to do with alleviating the suffering. Okay, it is different than empathy, and that's important because I think in our culture we talk about compassion, but I think often what we're talking about is empathy, which is means, you know, I feel the suffering, I feel your suffering, I feel others' suffering, I feel the suffering of the world, right? And many people find, and they think that's compassion. Now, that's what we would call empathy. Right? Compassion in Buddhism is active. Right? Empathy is what links us. Right? We have to be empathic so we come out of our own egocentric... you know, most of us are empathic to ourselves. Right? You know, we're present to our own suffering. And we're compassionate to ourselves, which we're always trying to do to get ourselves out of suffering, right? But empathy links us to other beings or to the world that suffers, but compassion means I want to alleviate the suffering of others, It's active. It doesn't get stuck in empathy. Many people get stuck in empathy, right? Which is a kind of a useless stuckness, right? Empathy links us to suffering, but there has to be a response. But many of us get stuck in empathy. And so that's why we often say, ooh, you know, too much, right? Too much to be around suffering people, too much to be aware of suffering people. It's too much for my heart, you see? And that's because we are stuck in empathy. Compassion means, well, what are you going to do? Huh? See, what are you going to do? Which is a very different question. It gets you out of the stuckness of empathy and stuckness in suffering and really challenges, say, well, what am I going to do? Can I do anything? Is there any way to help? Is what I'm doing really helping? Because compassion means I'm alleviating the suffering. So it's not enabling. It's not codependency where we're just supporting people suffering. It says, wow, you know, how do I? So often in Buddhism, the first thing that we notice is, well, have I ended my own suffering? I mean, have I really ended my own suffering? Have I liberated my own body, mind, the actions of my body, speech, and mind from suffering? I mean, that's one place to end the suffering of the world, right? End my own suffering, right? Have I really, in terms of my relationships with my family, my friends, my loved ones, my colleagues, do I show up as a compassionate human being? Present to their suffering and wanting to be of benefit? Or do I, you know, skip over that because I'm too concerned about the suffering of the world? So compassion is very central to Buddhist teachings, and it balances wisdom. Wisdom is really understanding the nature of things. But why do we want to understand the nature of things? So we can see where we're stuck and others are stuck and liberate them. So, why did the Buddha teach? You know, I mean, he had a great enlightenment experience, right? Everything was good. Right? Just had a great enlightenment experience. He dwelled in the joy and the bliss of complete absolute freedom. His mind totally open and spacious. Everything was perfect there in Bodh Gaya, India. You know. You know, why did he hit the road, right? You know, for 50 years, wandering around northern India with a begging bowl, right? Not easy. Right? Not only not easy wandering around northern India barefoot, but only with a begging bowl and only taking enough food for the day. Every day had to go out to whatever local village to get his food. Right? You see what I mean? You know what I mean? It's not an easy life. Why did he do it? Because he had compassion for suffering beings. And he wanted to be of help to them. So he wandered about. And he didn't just teach people, the monks and the nuns and the lay people who really wanted to spiritually develop themselves and become enlightened. He taught everybody. You know, village women who had lost their children, he taught. People possessed by their anger and their fear, he taught. Anybody could come to him, right? Why'd he do that? Because he was compassionate. He realized that human beings, you know, have this great treasure, this great pure Buddha mind within them. And yet, what did they do? They just create suffering for themselves and others, right? So he was motivated to help wake us up. And still to this day, we are very fortunate that this stream of Dharma that has only been preserved by teachers and masters for 2,600 years is still in this world to help wake us up, show us another way to live. Okay? Thank you. Good. Other questions? Yes.
Good to see you again.
Uh-huh.
I haven't researched this, but I have the question is, why do we bow to the Buddha, the actual stone figure?
Such as this one. Yeah.
I understand why we bow to each other.
Yeah.
But I don't understand the other.
Good. So that's a good question. Why do we bow to the Buddha? This image up here. You could understand why we bow to each other, but why do we bow to the Buddha? And for those of you who come out of a Judeo-Christian kind of biblical, you may have heard the term, do not bow before graven images. We're in big trouble, aren't we? So it's very interesting. I mean, again, to practice Buddhism, to be a Buddhist, to practice this way, one doesn't have to bow before Buddhas. I mean, this is an extra. Okay, so make clear. I mean, when we bow, we don't go around and make sure everybody's bowing, right? Salima's not instructed to keep her eye on everybody, and anybody's not bowing, let's catch them afterwards, or publicly castigate them. No, so we don't do that, as you might have noticed. But again, Buddhism has a 2,600-year tradition, and its tradition comes out of Asia. In Asia, people what? They bow. They bow to each other. It's a way of greeting. It's a way of showing respect. It's just a very traditional way. So it's very interesting that if you study the history of kind of Buddhist art, so at one point, the Buddha was a living presence in the world, right? So people bowed to him. But then he died. He passed. He went into Parinirvana. He passed. So he wasn't around anymore. Now he said, I leave you my Dharma. I leave you the teachings. I leave you the practices. But we're human beings. We like representations, right? So for hundreds of years, actually, after the Buddha's death, there were no images of the Buddha. They would. If you go to India, you can see there'd be footprints, just like impressions of a foot that were the Buddha's feet. And these are what they do. Or they would make a Dharma wheel, the eight-spoke wheel. So there were kind of representations of the Buddha Dharma, or the Buddha, that were kind of... And they would erect these places, primarily places where the Buddha had taught. Okay? Now, Buddhism began to spread, and one of the areas that it spread to in the early days, hundreds of years after the passing of the Buddha, was it spread east, through what's Pakistan, Afghanistan, and what they encountered were these Grecian states, right? Because the Greece influence had spread west, right? Actually, we know that what's his name? Not Hannibal, was it? Yeah, it came all the way to India, right? I mean, so we know there was a great, anybody know anything about Greek and art? What did they like to do? They make images. Right, all the Greek gods and if you ever go to a museum and you look at ancient Buddhist art, you will notice there are certain Buddhas, some of the oldest Buddhas. They're called Gandhara Buddhas. Gandhara was a Greek type state in Afghanistan or Iran or somewhere. And you know what the Buddhas look like? Look like Greeks. They have mustaches, and they wear these flowing Grecian robes. I mean, it's very interesting. So these were that's originally how images, and then it sort of came back into India, and it just kind of it became part of Buddhism. So there's a great tradition of Buddhist art. All right. Again, this is a, you know, we don't bow to this as a graven image, as a statue. We bow to it because it represents, it is symbolic, it links us to two things, to our tradition. You know, we are here today because of this tradition. And it also is a symbol. I mean, the Buddha, remember, the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, was not his name, right? His name was Siddhartha Gautama. That was his family name. Okay. He was called the Buddha because Buddha means enlightened one. Right. So anybody who becomes enlightened is a Buddha. Right. So in a well-made Buddha statue or painting, we see someone who is what? Sitting peacefully, solid, right? It's a representation of our nature, symbolic representation. Okay. So that's what we're bowing to. But we're human beings, right? Right? We give people cards on their birthday and anniversary. You know, I mean, we do symbolic representations all the time. That's what art's about. I mean, we express ourselves through different mediums, music, art. And you really see, wherever Buddhism went in Asia, arts flourished in that sense. And hopefully they will flourish here in the same way. Thank you. Other questions? Yes.
Once we understand that that's false, what is it helping alternative? Because although that's insidious and ultimately leads to suffering, it also drives us. And so it's like, if I think that this will make me happy, I'm going to chase it and I'm going to pursue it with all I have. Eventually I'll realize all that did is all of my problems and I still feel like I do, but it also drove me to accomplish. So once we understand that that's false, I'm going to solve.
So that's a deep question, which I'll answer quickly, shortly, you know what I'm saying. So the question is, when one gets the if-then of, you know, sort of what passes for ordinary experience in our life, you know, which is, you know, when you get this, then you'll be happy, right? Right? When you graduate from high school, then your life, you know, when you graduate from college, when you get the girlfriend, when you get the boyfriend, when you get the car, when you get the... the good time on Friday night, when you get the, you know, right? You know, it's like fill in the blank. And in our society, there are a million things you can fill in the blank. When I get the status, when I get the money, when I get a reputation, when I get the house, when I get the, right? Then I'll be what? Happy. So what you're talking about now is Dharma, right? Second path. You don't get that at the first path, right? All you get at the first path is, I'm really aware that I have a lot of craving in my mind. But the second path, the Dharma, begins to explain just what you said. Why is that? You know, why don't things and experiences give me any intrinsic happiness? They give me momentary happiness. Right? Right? Do you ever get what you want? What you, your if-then? When you get it, how do you feel?
Same.
Well, usually you feel good for a minute, or an hour, or a day, or three. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's not really the same. See what I'm saying? Because, right? So you feel some degree of satisfaction, happiness, fulfillment for a short period of time, but then you find, what is your name?
Eric.
So then you find slowly, you return back to where you were. Of course, the other side of the if-then is, and you might have noticed this, Eric, what happens when you don't get what you want?
Angry.
Yeah, yeah. Angry, frustrated, or disappointed, right. So there's really two things that we need to get, right? That if we're living life, if then, if I get this, then I will be this. Not only are we always chasing that, But 50% of it is, what happens when I don't get it? Or somebody else gets it, right? You see? That in Buddhism, and that's called suffering, right? In America, we call that everyday life. You see? The Buddha called that suffering, that endless, right? So you're absolutely right. So, you know, most people in our culture don't ever ask the question you ask, like, which is like, what's going on here? You know, I'm playing this game of life that I was taught by my family, by my society, that's supposed to produce what? Happiness, meaning, fulfillment, and I'm kind of doing it, and I'm kind of getting some of these things, or I'm getting all the things, and yet somehow that deep inner angst or not knowing or you know what I mean? It's still there. Right. So these are the kind of questions the Buddha asked. Right? Because he was young and he had money. You know what I mean? It's like, but what's going on here? So that's when we turn to Dharma. We go, you know, there's got to be another way, right? To approach life. It's not like that life is bad, you see. It's like how I'm approaching life, how I'm relating to life, that somehow doesn't work. It doesn't produce any intrinsic happiness or any kind of permanent well-being or peace of mind that just carries over day after day, week after week. It's always this kind of up and down, high, low, you know, happy, sad, calm, angry, in love, out of love, you know, liking, disliking, right? Yeah, so that's why we turn to Dharma. That's what the path is about. Okay, and a real spiritual path will explain to Eric why that is, so he understands. Because in our society, see what happens, Eric. When Eric begins to question it like that, the answer is, well, Eric, the problem is you. You see, you're not trying hard enough, right? You're not, you know what I mean. You gotta, you know, right? You gotta kind of, you know, you're just not, you know, it's. The carrot's out there, Eric. You just kind of work a little harder, be a little more focused, put in more hours, you know, maybe you just need more things. You see, you just don't have enough things yet, Eric. Right? Isn't that what society will tell you? Or else it'll tell you, you know, you need to kind of chill out. You say, Eric, you need to kind of, you know, after work, why don't you hit the bar, you know, or, you know, take something or smoke something or see a psychiatrist or something, get something, you know. Because there's something wrong with you, Eric. See, but there's really nothing wrong with you, Eric. See, it's like, you know, the emperor's new clothes. Remember, everybody remember that Hans Christian Andersen? You know, it's like, you know, everybody's going to the emperor, what? Wow, what a beautiful suit he has. Wow, he's so, you know, remember? Everybody's into the, and it's only the little boy who goes, what? Mommy. The emperor's naked. You remember that? And everybody goes, what? Shh. Shh, right? But see, the child, he saw it. But everybody else was going, oh, the emperor, what a beautiful suit of clothes. Everybody remember the story? I don't need to tell it. Emperor's new clothes, yeah. So it's like that, you see. You know, in our society, there are these, you know, cultural norms, these cultural truths that are passed down as truths, you see, and that nobody or very few people fundamentally challenge, do they? Right? Because if they do begin to challenge and people go, Eric, you need to chill out, you know? You know what I mean? What's he talking about? Come on, let's go out and get drunk, you know? It's like, right? You know, or let's go watch a movie. Come on, Eric, Eric's bringing us down. Right? You know, all of a sudden, Eric's no fun anymore, is he? Who wants to be around Eric when he's talking this way? You see, who wants to hang out with Eric? Right? He talks about the meaning of life and it's just kind of purposeless, and right? I don't want to go out with him anymore. That's why we need to have community where we can say these things openly and go, yeah, you're right. Yeah, the emperor has no clothes. Yeah, he's naked. Yeah, there is no essential intrinsic happiness or meaning in the acquisition of things. Right? See, am I allowed to say that publicly? You see, because we have a whole culture, a whole economy, we have a whole political structure that's based on what? What? Consuming. More and more. Look beautiful, right? Now we have what? Human beings as a brand. I mean, that's insane. Right? I'm not a person. I'm not a human being. I'm a brand. A brand is something that's a commodity. It's something to make money with. Right? So you're on the right path, or at least you're in safe. You're safe here. You know, that's one of the reasons we have Sangha. That's one of the reasons we have a wake-up group for people in their 20s and 30s, you know, just to provide an alternative kind of environment where people can, young people can learn, you know, there is a better way to live. And again, we don't know that. You know, we might have had loving parents, but they didn't, you know. You see what I'm saying? And we might have had good teachers in school, but they didn't teach us this. Right? They didn't teach us how to have a happy mind. They didn't teach us how to have a calm mind. They didn't teach us about what really has. I mean, not that. That's extreme. I mean, hopefully, maybe along the way, there were people who kind of understood some of this. So, anyhow, we'll leave it there. And other questions? Yes. No. Right, so that's again in a very small way, but very indicative that the message we get in society is always there's something wrong with the way we are and we can always be better. You see? And you wonder why so many people have this kind of sense of deficiency. Right? Because, you know, it's like you can always have less wrinkles. Of course, you know, right? But unfortunately, we can't return to being a baby. So we're either endlessly buying potions and lotions, or we're getting plastic surgery, which is also a booming, you know, because, again, it's all about there's something wrong with the, you know, we're not enough. You know, it's like a cultural epidemic that people feel that there's something wrong with them. They're not enough. But we don't realize that in very subtle ways we're getting the message. You know, we're not pretty enough. We're not handsome enough. We're not smart enough. We don't have enough friends on Facebook. You know, we're what? You know, we don't have enough money. We don't have, you know, our house, our car. You know, it's always what? Yeah, something else. And again, it doesn't mean, you know, that we all live in hovels. You know what I mean? That's not the alternative. But it means that at a certain point, you're okay. It's like Eric said, you know, you're okay with life. You're okay with yourself. You know, you know what's meaningful and purposeful, and you know what's not. Right? And so for you, being free of wrinkles may not be the most significant thing in your life. But there are people where that is probably the most significant thing, or one of, and that's kind of sad. Because underneath that is anxiety. You see, it's not like a benign mental state. There's anxiety about how I look and how I perceive, and how other people perceive me, you see. So it's not like benign, it's anxiety producing. Yes.
Speaking of anxiety.
Yes.
As a college student, I've been having to practice public speaking, and I find no matter how prepared I am, I become so anxious and nervous that I become physically ill.
Mm-hmm.
And even right now, I wish I had a note card.
All right, but hold on. What's your name again?
Amalia.
Amalia, that's right, Amalia.
And,
okay, stop, just stop a second. So right now, I don't want to scare you, but right now you are public speaking. You're speaking in public. Okay? Just relax. Everything's okay. Nobody's judging you. The fate of mankind is not resting on what you say. I just want to just make you know that, okay? So just relax. And you're speaking very good. You're saying what you need to say, aren't you? Yeah, that was very clear. Okay? So it is not about your ability to speak publicly. Okay? It's interesting. See, that's a capacity you seem to have. And you put your thoughts together well, and you were fine. See, the problem is there's something else going on, isn't there? That has nothing to do with public speaking. It has to do with what? Me. But luckily, it's not the real you. But it's kind of this story about you and who you are and what people think of you and you see what I'm saying and all that kind of stuff. That's the world of self. That's the world of ego. In Buddhism, it's called the world of delusion, the world of suffering. And so you got to begin to separate out. See, this is where with the Dharma and mindfulness, you begin to see my suffering is not coming from public speaking. Right? My suffering is not coming from speaking to other people. That's all we're doing in public speaking, right? We're just speaking to other people. The problem becomes I have these stories about myself. And the stories you have make you anxious. Right? So now you know where you need to look and work. And there are lots of ways of dealing with that. It's not a big deal. Okay? Because you just did a great job. Did you know that? Hmm? I mean, I'd ask you to get up here and give a talk, but I don't. Are you ready for that?
I have to give one in 2 weeks. It's 15 minutes long.
Hold on. I mean, are you always like in silence in your life? Do you ever talk to anybody? You do. Have you ever talked to anybody without cards, without preparation for 10 or 15 minutes? Let me get this straight. So you have the capacity of talking spontaneously, somewhat intelligently about something for 10 or 15 minutes without weeks of preparation. You do. Well, that's wonderful to know. So you have that ability, except what are you doing to yourself?
Sometimes I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you want to know, okay? And you see how... See, a lot of times this over-preparation that people do is part of their... It's not about the talk. It's about your anxiety. You're trying to kind of deal with your anxiety by just going over and over things. But to me, that usually just is feeding the anxiety. Because it's the message you're telling yourself is, unless I really get this over-prepared and know everything and kind of just manage the whole process, and well, you know what I mean? Right? It's going to be a disaster. Disaster could happen. There's no disaster. Okay. The opposite of anxiety is confidence. Right? Confidence is a human quality. And confidence comes with the practice because you're confident in yourself, not your ego self, but your deeper self. Right? You trust your own wisdom, you trust your own experience, and you trust your own ability that whatever happens, you'll deal with it. Right? Let's say whatever this talk is, you've got to give it at your class. Let's say it's total mess. Right? The worst thing possible. Right? You say you get it all backwards, people laugh, people walk out. Right? You know, total disaster. Amalia, so what? So what? So what? I mean, you know, is your life going to be radically changed? No. Are you still a decent human being? Are they going to throw you out of college for what? No. So we got to be realistic too. Right? How do you get better at public speaking? Do more public speaking. But also take care of this part of you that gets freaked out. Calm her. Stabilize her. Take care of her. Okay? And then you give a good speech. Yes?
I just wanted to share a reminder. I kind of had a similar path. And I found myself thrust into a situation where I was having to speak publicly all of a sudden a lot. And had never done it. My palms would sweat. And someone said, well, you've got a lot to share.
Yeah.
And I took that home with me and said, that's what this is about. This is about sharing. And that I'm giving.
There you go. Let me just repeat this because this is being live streamed. So, yeah. So the point he's making is also a wonderful point, which is, most people, their fears are based on others, right? You know, your palms are sweating because you think, what? I'm going to make a fool of myself, or blah, blah, blah. People think I'm stupid, you know what I mean? So it's because we're focused on others. But really what you did from a Buddhist point of view is you left that one, and you just came back and said, I'm just sharing something, you know, something I know, something I'm excited about, something I believe, right? Now it's in the place of you, right? And then it was easy.
And then the next step was making it fun.
Yeah.
So then I started making jokes, and it became a fun thing to do instead of this very anxious
right.
experience.
Good. Yeah. So good. Is that? Yeah. Yeah. Good. Other questions? Yes. Good.
But we're talking about anxiety, and I have a very powerful social anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And like sitting here,
yeah.
falling out of my skin.
Good. Yeah. Good. Mm-hmm.
How do I really want to connect?
Yeah. There you go.
How do I get over that fear?
Yeah. Okay. So, you know. Oh, so the. I'm sorry, I got to repeat the question. So the question is somebody saying, you know, I have a deep desire wanting to connect with people, wanting to connect, but I have this, I just am overwhelmed with anxiety, you know, in social situations, you know, very visceral kind of physical, okay, which is not unknown. Now, again, let me just say, since for many years I was a therapist, okay, let me just say that social anxieties, personal anxieties, are one of the most treatable of the kind of emotional disorders, so to speak. So there's no reason for you to suffer. And from a therapeutic point of view, to find somebody who has expertise in treating people with anxieties, right? Expertise. I'm not saying you go to any therapist, but somebody who has expertise could be very beneficial to you. All right? At the same time, right, I'm saying that, you know, you may need to just, you know, get with somebody who's skilled in that area. At the same time, it's very much like Amalia, right? You're saying, as a human being, I want to connect with people. I want to be able to be around people and relax, be relaxed, be open, right? Right? And yet there's this thing going on. Is it coming from here? Is there any anxiety in this hall? No, so it's not coming from out here. Is there anything I'm projecting to you to making you scared? No. So you know it's coming from where? It's coming from your mind. Okay, very interesting. It may be manifesting in your body, right? But it's really coming from your mind. I mean, your mind, your body doesn't care what's going on, does it? Does your body care what people think about it? No. So it's. So our poor bodies are kind of holding, you know, the emotion, but the truth is it's coming all from our mind. So that is why in Buddhism we practice mindfulness, we practice meditation, because these are technologies that deal directly with the mind, right? So you know it's not about public speaking. It's not about any of that. It's about somehow this mind got conditioned at some point. And if you kind of know your story, some people know their story well and know how things began. Some people, that's part of their journey, to begin to understand that this mind of yours, these emotional afflictions that arise in our mind, are not the natural condition of our mind, right? Something happened. In Buddhism, we call that cause and effect, karma. This produces that, right? If at this point in your life you have lots of social anxieties, right? It's because, see, I don't know, but I know something happened. You weren't born with it. So along the way, something happened, okay? That then begin to condition you to respond to life in this fearful way, right? Then, if you just kept for years repeating that cycle, you know, in social situations and interactions, it just got what? Kind of more ingrained. Till you reach a point in your life where you think, oh, this is the way I am. You see? Amalia may say, well, this is just the way I am. No, this is not the way you were. This is not where you were. This is the way your mind got conditioned along the way. And because we misidentify. We don't understand that we're Buddhas. We don't understand that our minds have this innate openness and purity, right? We think this mind with all its problems, all its issues, that's me. No, that's not. That's just the way your mind's been conditioned, right? It's like, you know, if your house is filthy, why is your house filthy? Because that's its nature, right? Cat says, yeah. So you blame the house that it's a mess, right? I see. Well, Cat, I hate to kind of disabuse you. The house is neutral. There's somebody who, what, hasn't been taking care of it, right? And rather than saying, well, I guess got to sell the house or get a new house, you know, it's too filthy, there is a simpler solution, which is what, Kat? Go home today and, okay. What this means is this mind of ours, right, was not born this way. It's been conditioned this way. And it can be cleaned up. It can be changed. You know, and there's a certain kind of way to go about that. I mean, we don't have time today, but understand that that is certainly possible. The question is, which is stronger? Your yearning to be free? Your yearning to connect? Or your entrenchment in your fears? Right? So there needs to be courage. Good. Good, that's wonderful. Yeah, I mean, that's wonderful. And you see, that's what you got to, you know, all of us, no matter how screwed up we are, okay, also have these other parts of us, you know? The part that knows we're screwed up. You see, the part that knows we're screwed up is healthy. Right? Can you see? That's a healthy part of us, right? So you're saying that part of me that wants to connect and knows that these fears are getting in the way of that, see, that's a healthy part of you, isn't it? And we need to learn to nurture, connect with, listen to that healthy part of us, right? For some of us, it's not a very strong voice, right? The other voices are stronger. So that's why in practice we're learning to cultivate that voice, to trust that voice, right? So that's, I mean, you know, that's great, what you just did, right? What? No, well, it doesn't, right. The important thing is that you realize, you know, and you know, your yearning to connect is the opposite of the yearning to stay stuck, just to continue to suffer. Right? Now, unfortunately for all of us, it's not overnight. It's not like you're going to walk out here today and, you know, it's like, you know, hands-on healing or something, you know. Hallelujah. You know? So this is not that, okay? It's a process, you see. But once you understand, it is a process. The mind has been conditioned towards suffering. The mind can be unconditioned. The mind can be retrained. It's just the mind that works, and Buddhism deals with the mind, right? So we want to, you know, the practices are learning to recondition, right? It's like with Amalia or Rick with their public speaking. It's like, it's, you know, when you think it's you, it's overwhelming. But what I'm saying, no, it's just, you know, there's this fear arising over here that wants to take over, you know, my college career. I'm not going to let it. But I'm not going to, you know, destroy it. I'm going to heal it. Because it's a wounded part of me. That's all. And you begin to develop a relationship with that part of you that's so afraid, right? It's not your enemy. You don't have to hate her. You don't have to be disgusted by her. You don't have to be sick of her. In Buddhism, our tools are understanding and compassion, right? You want to understand that part of you suffers, right? And that part of you needs to be understood, you know? You understand she is the way she is because of the way her life has unfolded. But in this moment and going forward, you can do it differently. How do I do it differently? Well, it's like we've been talking about. We need a path, right? We need some way to deal with things. And again, luckily, you know, within the therapeutic world and within the Dharma world, there are tried and true methods that can help us. We don't have to continue to suffer. And that's good to know, you know, that we can be free.